Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey, welcome back to the Mining Pod. On today's show, we're going back in time into the archives to celebrate the Bitcoin halving with the show from October of 2021 with Alex Gladstein of the Human Rights Foundation and Diverter, who wrote Mining for the Streets. We're also joined by our former co-host, Zach Full, for this conversation. This is one of our best performing episodes ever, and it takes a zoomed out approach on why Bitcoin mining matters, why a Bitcoin miner as a sovereign individual has the ability to separate money and state from the genesis of that money, which is Bitcoin mining. So great conversation here. Again, one of our all-time best performing podcasts because it does really cast a new lens on what Bitcoin mining is all about. Yeah, we talk about software. Yeah, we talk about the nuts and bolts all the time, Bitcoin mining, maybe some technical stuff, but this is why Bitcoin mining really matters. Okay, before we get into the show, we want to thank CleanSpark, America's Bitcoin miner, and Forman Mining, Master Your Mining, for being the lead sponsors for the Mining Pod. Without them, this show would not be possible. Thank you to both of them. Okay, a few words from our sponsors, and then on to the conversation.
Hey, listeners, let's talk about revolutionizing your mining operation with Forman. This isn't your average management tool. It's an all-in-one solution for reducing costs and significantly boosting your revenue. Forman brings a cutting-edge dashboard to your fingertips, empowering you with automated energy strategies. This means not only curtailing around real-time prices, but also strategically enhancing your profit margins through demand response. It's about leveraging energy efficiency to its fullest potential. With Forman, you get a system that scales with your business, inventory management for assets, infrastructure integration, and business intelligence. Forman elevates the cash flow and production of your entire operation. To see how Forman can redefine your mining operation standards, visit Forman.mn. With Forman, you're not just managing a mining operation, you're setting a new standard in the industry.
Are you a retail or institutional investor interested in Bitcoin mining companies? The Miner Mag brings you free data and analysis from all major NASDAQ-listed Bitcoin mining operations to know who stands out. Check out visualized metrics and data-dependent stories at theminermag.com.
I'm really excited for today's show. We typically just talk about Bitcoin mining, like the tech itself, where we have like Flare and Oil guys on, which of course is really interesting to you and I, but there's a bigger picture here that's worth discussing, and that's Bitcoin itself and the macro implications and then the human rights applications for itself. So I think this could be one of the more important streams we ever do on the show.
Yeah, for sure. Not that miner extractable value isn't important, but the reason why we're all here is pretty important too. So before we jump into the topic for today, financial sovereignty through Bitcoin mining, Alex and Diverter, I want to turn it over to you guys just to give short introductions to yourselves, how you got into Bitcoin in terms of the industry more generally, and just a little bit about what you're working on now. You both are very prolific writers and educators and sort of spokespersons and thought leaders without any sort of cringe attached to that label in this industry. Very honored to have you both on the stream. Diverter, I'll hand it to you first, if you don't mind. Just tell us a little bit about who you are, what you're working on, and how you came here.
Sure, thanks. And I definitely want to avoid the cringe as much as I can. I'm just some dude that likes Bitcoin. I've got the shortest intro in the whole space. I like it for all the things that it can be, and I like it for all the things that it already is today, and for a lot of the things that it can do for us. My story is not a whole lot different from many people, I would imagine. Originally just kind of looking for a place to park and make some money. bought some Bitcoin, basically thought it was a stock, long story short. And then 2017 bull market happened and something clicked when I saw this price that it made me want to dig deeper because there was obviously something that I was missing. Like, this is obviously not just some stock. Something is going on here. And the rest is kind of history. Down the rabbit hole I tumbled and started getting much more. It ignited a years old fire and from the way that I was brought up and a lot of the things, you know, from my past, and it really reignited a search for more personal and individual sovereignty and liberty that had kind of been doused because I couldn't see a way to properly do it. And this was the missing piece. It was like Bitcoin was the missing piece that really unlocked this thing to where I felt like it could go from being more than just, you know, something we get on online and just mentally masturbate about. Like, now we can actually do something with this. So it really kickstarted a lot for me. I've got a real passion for it. And what I'm doing right now is basically trying to find holes wherever I feel like there's a hole in something that people aren't doing because they think it's very difficult. For example, mining at home or self-hosting your own products or tools. It seems very difficult, but in reality, it's actually not if you have just a little bit of guidance. So I kind of try to search for those little holes and throw some kind of educational content out there to wet people's beak, just get them started. Once you're started, I have full faith and confidence that people can figure it out for themselves. So that's about it.
That's awesome. I can relate with much of what you've said, including, you know, the urge to make mining seem, you know, more accessible. Not that it isn't inaccessible, but there is sort of that stigma that it's just a little bit hard to penetrate if you want to, you know, run an S9 or two of them in your home, and pushing those mental barriers to joining mining down as low as possible is a very rewarding and noble effort. And you've definitely written some great content on that front. Alex, turn it over to you too. I mean, I doubt anyone in our audience is not familiar with you and your work constantly traversing the globe, educating people about Bitcoin and pushing for its adoption and recognition. But can you tell us a little bit of the brief summary of your backstory, how you got into Bitcoin and what you're working on now?
Sure. I've been working at the Human Rights Foundation since around 2007. In 2013, some Ukrainians came to us and they were like, hey, Bitcoin's getting kind of big here as like a protest currency. Can we talk about it? And I remember having some calls towards the end of that year as that country started to head towards Maidan Square in early 2014 and the whole like kind of uprising and democratic revolution. But at the time, I was pretty skeptical, actually. We started to accept Bitcoin at the Human Rights Foundation that same year, and that was great for us and everything, but I didn't really get it beyond like just sort of, as Diverter said, maybe like a stock type thing that you could donate or exchange. I didn't really understand the depth really until I started digging into it, which would be in the spring of 2017. But ever since then, I've been like totally obsessed with learning as much as I can about it and then sharing that knowledge with other people. And I think that mining is hugely important, not just to understand from a security point of view, not just to understand from a game theory point of view, like globally or geopolitically, but from an individual point of view, I think it can be, my opinion is irrelevant. It is a very large empowerment tool for people around the world. And I think that there are valid concerns over, like surveillance of, you know, the electricity consumption if you're mining. And what's cool is those can be ameliorated by using generators or solar panels. And I just think this is a lexicon and discourse that should be discussed more so that people who have access to these things realize that they can actually start making, freedom money. That's like, you know, non-KYC, that is, you know, in a parallel economy, that they can convert electricity into this freedom money and then use it for their, whatever they need to do. So I think this part of the discourse is brand new, essentially. I mean, borderline. I had Econo Alchemist put together a video for us at the Oslo Freedom Forum a few weeks ago to show activists why Bitcoin mining matters for freedom and how to do it. And I think we should build on top of that and continue to discuss this, because there's so many people around the world who need like freedom money and may not have access to like banking systems or a Coinbase or something like that, but maybe they do have a generator and, you know, maybe they can get their hands on an ASIC. So let's keep talking about this topic.
Yeah, that's an amazing message. And Econo Alchemist was on a stream a bit ago with us. He's also a fantastic individual and educator on mining. And Alex, I sort of want to keep going with something you were talking about, and Diverti, you touched on it too, to sort of set the stage for our conversation today. Like, people, like, the big picture goal here is giving people access to Bitcoin. And for many people, the easiest way is to just simply exchange their local sovereign currency for Bitcoin. And mining sort of seems like a little bit of a higher hurdle to jump to get access to this freedom money. Even though it may come with, you know, significantly more advantages and stuff like that, it's a little bit more resource intensive. So I guess the opening question I have is like why mining? It's loud. It can be resource intensive. It can be hot. What's so special about mining in particular in your mind? If you were, you know, speaking to someone brand new to Bitcoin, interested in getting involved as much as they can, or who has a real need for Bitcoin, just like extrapolating a bit more on like why mining matters in terms of propelling Bitcoin's utility as sort of a tool for financial freedom instead of, you know, just sort of exchanging fiat currency for Bitcoin through an exchange or payment service. I guess I can hand it back to Alex first and then to Werner.
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously it's a bit of a hobbyist thing now. Like, you have to devote, as Werner said, you need guidance, but you also need time. It's not trivial at the moment to, you know, like outfit the ASIC, assuming you can get one and it works, with perhaps the equipment necessary to make its noise and heat like reasonable for you and your family. But I suspect a lot of people doing this for freedom reasons will actually perhaps have a place to do it that's maybe not their home, and they don't have to worry about those things, and it's a little easier. And as Econo Alchemist points out, like once it's up and running, it's the easiest part is connecting it to the internet and starting to get paid. So I think that, and I was talking to some folks in Nigeria the other day about this, like there's just a massive amount of potential for people to understand that they can generate freedom money through mining through an ASIC. That thought just like hasn't crossed billions of people's minds yet. So we're just early. And I think the more that we can share the fact that this is one way to do it, and it's arguably the best way to do it for privacy in terms of accumulating Bitcoin or opting into the Bitcoin economy. There's other ways you can do it that are fairly private, whether it be earning or peer-to-peer, but there's always kind of a third parties there. But if you know what you're doing and you're mining, like it's pretty good on the privacy front. So I think it meshes well from that perspective. If you're a human rights activist in the authoritarian regime and you need to keep your movement going, or you need to feed your family when you've been fired for your job because of what you believe in or something like that, hey, you can use the grid. And a lot of people just might plug into the grid, and maybe that's fine. But I've seen in certain countries like Venezuela and others, like the government monitors the grid sometimes and will come after you. So I think it's important to mention that even that can be ameliorated. So I guess that's where I would start with, and I'll hand it over to Diverter.
From my side, it all comes down to three little letters. It's KYC. Know your customer, anti-money laundering regulations, and their constant march towards infringing on everyone's personal and financial privacy and freedom, and the ability of people to transact without asking permission. Permissionlessness is top of the line. When we're talking about freedom money, this word freedom can mean several different things. You know, sure, it's the freedom from perhaps, you know, inflation worries. You know, you if you're simply just holding Bitcoin, you that is, in a sense, you're gaining freedom from the constant crush of inflation and the debasement of your currency that happens everywhere around the world. But at the end of the day, what we're really wanting to do is to be able to utilize this tool completely free of any sort of legacy financial system. It was designed to work as such. We don't need them. They want us. We don't need them. And so what they try to do then is they try to, since they can't directly attack, they'll try to come around through the back door and just slowly try to squeeze everyone into these little bottlenecks where they can get, if we can just get everybody that's buying Bitcoin to register all their information with us, well, then when the day comes that we're ready to take some sort of drastic action and limit people's freedoms, what do you know? We have a handy little list here to choose from. Now, of course, it'll never be, you know, marketed that way. They'll, you know, it's to save the children or protect from terrorist financing, however you want to wrap the thing. But at the end of the day, it comes down to financial surveillance and how that affects people's privacy. So what got me into Bitcoin mining personally was just looking at the landscape and watching as it seemed almost daily more and more. These KYC and AML regulations just kept creeping forward. And at this point, we're in a dead sprint. They're just running for everybody as fast as they can go. And I wanted a way out. There are options, as Alex mentioned. You have some peer-to-peer exchanges, so places like BISC and HODL and those sort of exchanges. But, you know, again, these are all, I just kept seeing targets. These are all targets. All these things are going to eventually be come for by these regulators. So I'm looking for an exit. What can I do? How can I put myself in a situation to where I can be receiving Bitcoin without having to go through the KYC AML regulations, without having to ask permission from anyone in order to do it? And that's what kind of landed me on mining. That's what got this whole thing kicked off, was just trying to find a way to acquire non-KYC Bitcoin. So the business aspect, the profit aspect was honestly, at the time I started looking into it, I wasn't that interested in it. It's not that I can stand to lose all my money. I certainly don't want to do that either. But what I was specifically looking for is, does this solve this problem? And it does in many ways. So that's why I'm so excited about mining at home specifically, for people to be able to mine for themselves just with an ASIC or two, what I kind of call GarageBand miners. Not necessarily worried about profit at, you know, times like right now when it's very profitable. Hey, that's great. But at the end of the day, what they're really here for is to get these sats in their own personal wallets without having to hand over their identification to do so. That's a major win.
Yeah, Diverter, you kind of touched on an interesting point there earlier, which is that it's very easy to get Bitcoin from an exchange, but Bitcoin mining is like a little bit more difficult. And I feel like that exchange side of the industry has really been built out so well, where it's very simple. And now we have all these other protocols out there that are also trying to emulate the ability to buy Bitcoin or buy cryptocurrency very easily, but on the protocol side. So that'd be like validation. And Alex, I kind of want to throw this question back to you, because I've seen you talk a lot against staking, and you've been very vocal against whether that's Ethereum or other altcoins trying to emulate mining through this staking process. And I just want to get your thoughts on why that's fair or unfair, and then as that pertains to Bitcoin mining itself.
Yeah, I think it comes from a place of wanting people to question what they're being told, and realizing that, like, proof of stake essentially is the existing system. And, you know, maybe it's different in slightly different, obviously, than a central bank, and the way that the business community interacts with the central bank, the way that commercial banks interact with central banks. Like, okay, so the money creation is going to be slightly different in a proof of stake blockchain, but the incentive structure is pretty similar, and the way it can be captured is pretty similar, and the way it can be corrupted is pretty similar. And I think people should know that there is a way out, like that there is a way to issue money that is not susceptible to this sort of cancel on effect. And that is proof of work. And that ultimately is not all that you need, obviously. And proof of work was invented in the 90s, you know, by a bunch of people, including Adam Back, you know, for different things. It has to be placed in an elegant system of user control to actually kind of really tick. And because Bitcoin has this full node architecture that allows users to control which blocks are valid and which software they want to run, it creates this super powerful effect of money issuance that's predetermined and can't be changed. And that is sort of a level playing field. I mean, yeah, it does not address the fact that if you're super rich, you can buy a lot of Bitcoin, of course, but that person can't then like prevent you and I from transacting, or can't prevent like some refugee from accessing the network. And there's no special rules for that person. Unlike in proof of stake systems, where like someone who's super rich or close to the creator can have more influence over the modification of the protocol, for example. Like that's how it would be in like a system like Ethereum, for example. So I think it's incumbent upon us to help people learn about this difference so fundamental. It's not to say that there won't be tremendous wealth created and good things done with fiat systems. I mean, we're all products of it, you know, like some of us are doing good things, others of us are not. Amazing things have been created. Amazing things have been destroyed. There's the full spectrum of human reality and existence in the last 50 years in the fiat world, right? And similarly in the digital space, like you're going to have, I am sure, towering wealth created and all new systems create. You're already seeing this now, obviously, with these different proof of stake systems. But at the end of the day, similar injustices still exist in these systems as to the current legacy financial system. And I think that that's something that proof of work addresses. That's one part of it. The other part of it is just that I think that geopolitically proof of work helps create a system that's actually censorship resistant due to the rivalrous nature of the world. And that like over time, governments and corporations are all going to want to mine Bitcoin. You're going to have a situation where if, you know, one party wants to censor your transactions, it doesn't matter because someone else will accept it. You don't have like a homogenous global society or government. There's always going to be competition and rebels. And even if 140 countries agree to ban Bitcoin mining, the other 40 are going to be like, come on over here. You know, we'd love to work with you. So there's that. And then there's the broader piece, which I really believe in as well, which is that I think that it changes humans' relationship with energy. And that like, I think it could push us to a world that's less kind of oil centric. And that to me is important for human rights reasons. Like I think a lot of these dictators, and a lot of the ways that the fiat money works is related actually to energy and oil, and in a way that's, I think, a little unhealthy. And I think we're still going to have this very important relationship to energy, but I think it'll be a little bit different with proof of work as opposed to with the way that currently the reserve currency of the world is issued ad infinitum, at least up until this sort of present moment. Because other nations want to save in our debt. Like, and that was something that was like politically created, in the 70s and, has been pretty genius actually for several decades, but it's starting to come unraveling. Right. And, I think it's cool because proof of work allows us to envision a world reserve currency that doesn't have to run on pacts with dictators, and doesn't have to run on, you know, the fossil fuel industry being able to shut out its competition and attack nuclear and stuff like that. I think it's really neat and it opens up a lot of possibilities. So I have a lot of different appreciations for proof of work. Let's put it that way.
In the competitive world of Bitcoin mining, one name stands out: CleanSpark, America's Bitcoin miner. At CleanSpark, efficiency isn't just a goal, it's our standard. Our sophisticated facilities are built and led by expert teams who care about Bitcoin and the communities we work in. Scale, we've mastered it. Our large-scale operations have set us apart in the industry as examples of community-oriented building. Our track record speaks for itself. We navigate the complexities of the new economy with precision and with skill, continuously achieving operational milestones. Curious about how we do it? We invite you to discover the story behind CleanSpark success at cleanspark.com.
I agree with almost everything you said there. I think, at least in my mind, you know, the beauty of this entire, if you want to call it an industry, the cryptocurrency industry, whatever you want to call it, is people can come for many different reasons. You know, maybe there are, or I know there are, like technologists that maybe have a concept in their mind. They want to come just see if they can build it and make it function. And there are obviously speculative investors who come in with large or medium or small amounts of money and are just trying to flip it for larger amounts of money. And then, like, you know, more pertinent to the conversation we're having today, and in my mind, probably closer to like world-changing technology goals and stuff like that, there are people who want to anonymously participate in a permissionless financial system by mining sats to their wallet in their homes or garage or backyard or whatever. And not to say any one of those particular reasons for entering the space are right or wrong, but I think there definitely can be like a hierarchy established in terms of what propels human flourishing forward further than others. But like you said, Alex, there's definitely a spectrum of reasons and scale of participation and things. But Diverto, I kind of want to touch on something you mentioned. And that is, like, at least in my mind, one of the key advantages of mining at home, the non-KYC element. And, it, you know, when people, well, I guess when people just buy Bitcoin, let alone when they start considering mining, almost always it's about the profitability and ROI, and usually dollar denominated returns on sort of their participation. And the non-KYC element can often be underappreciated. I'm just curious if you can expand on that a little bit more. And also maybe I think some of our audience may not be familiar with your pretty seminal work, Mining for the Streets, in terms of a manifesto and manual and primer on the idea that everyone can mine and it's not hard to get started. And the benefits of creating your own Bitcoins basically anonymously or as anonymously as possible is incredibly valuable, even if your operation isn't super profitable from the start. So I'll just turn it over to you. Can you just speak to that a little bit, the value of more of non-KYC sats, and then your work mining for the streets?
Sure. This whole thing about KYC, non-KYC, what's happened is KYC has been, the term itself has been turned into a sort of a catch-all to kind of talk about anything that requires any sort of identifiable information in any capacity. They'll just call it KYC. And it's very important to distinguish between these different levels of privacy, whether you are being anonymous or pseudonymous, whether you are going through the actual KYC process, which is a very specific process whereby your information is essentially gathered on a warrantlessly available database that can pretty much, using a third party doctrine, just be scraped at will. And so it's a very tricky thing. But what's very important to understand is that the KYC and the setup of the exchanges and the stuff, it all is about inconveniences and adding little bitty things and perhaps making it a little bit more expensive to go the more private route, which is almost always the case. And those little bit of inconveniences or perhaps a little bit higher price tag ends up pushing people towards the more convenient route, which is inevitably centralized KYC exchanges. What I'm fond of saying, and a couple others are as well, is that it's not so much that there is a premium on non-KYC sats. The reality is the non-KYC price, that is the price. That's the street price. When you buy on a centralized KYC exchange, you're actually getting a discount. You're getting a discount for your data. That kind of changed that mind frame, which is exactly what I wanted to do with Mining for the Streets. At the time that I wrote that, as I said, I was looking for a way to get into non-KYC acquisition of Bitcoin, and mining seemed to fit the bill. So I go searching around for information. Everywhere I looked, all I could find was discouragement. Everywhere I looked, everyone was saying, don't do it. Don't even try it. You can't mine at home anymore. It's not profitable anymore. You can't compete. Just buy Bitcoin. You'll come out better. Everywhere I turned, it seemed I couldn't find anyone that was actually encouraging me on any of the, whether it be on Reddit or on Twitter, just anywhere. It was always a discouragement. Sometimes it was outright, sometimes just, you know, no, it's not that big, you know, just buy Bitcoin, just buy Bitcoin. So my whole thinking was, I've got to get something out here to try to change the way that this industry is viewed, from one of being solely a business into one of being an actual acquisition method of Bitcoin. So the way I look at it, the way I termed it, is mining at home is a way for you to dollar cost average into Bitcoin. You're essentially DCAing, but you're doing it through your electric bill. Right? You plug your miner in, you use your electricity, you are dollar cost averaging into Bitcoin, except you're not paying an exchange, you're paying your electric bill, your electric provider. It's the same exact procedure. You're paying off money and you're receiving Bitcoin. There is no difference. It's the same thing as signing up on Coinbase or wherever else that you put in a dollar cost average order. And if you're able to do this, and you're able to do so at a rate that is, say maybe you even lose a cent or two, maybe even a dollar a day, are you willing to pay that extra dollar a day to know that your data is now not available on this KYC database? Is that worth it to you? And if you ask some of the people that are more interested in privacy and sovereignty and security and things of that nature, I'm quite sure that they would agree. If you go on to BISC or HODL, you're more than likely you're going to pay a little bit more than the spot price most times. Sometimes you won't, but most of the time you'll be paying a little bit more than what you would on a Coinbase or a Kraken, one of those major exchanges. So it's kind of understood that there is a sort of a privacy premium. So that's okay. We can deal with that. The problem becomes getting people to see this thing as not as a competition. You've got to understand that you're not necessarily competing against these huge mining farms. All right. Those huge mining farms, they can get all the stats that they want to get. But if you plug a miner in, it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's an S9 or a brand new S19, whatever it is, however many hashes you can contribute to your mining pool, you're going to get paid for that amount of hashes back. So you're not necessarily competing against these huge mining farms. You are contributing to the network. And by you contributing to the network, you receive Bitcoin as a payment. So it's important because the incentives all align, which as we all know, I mean, incentives are everything. It's why Bitcoin is so beautiful. If everyone acts in their own best interest, that is what's helping the network. It's in your own interest to run a node. It's in your own interest to run your own miner. This is your real money that you've got on the line here. Don't you want to be a part of helping to secure that if you can? I know I do. So all these things are available. It's just a matter of narrative shifting, because narratives in Bitcoin are very important. I know we don't like to talk about it that much and we like to dismiss it. There is no such thing as a Bitcoin community. Narratives don't matter. It's all individuals. But in reality, in the real world, narratives matter immensely. It really matters because it changes the conversations that people have. If nobody's even talking about mining at home, then there's no discussion of it. It's not even a thought that may enter your mind. So suddenly I put this paper out and I had the good fortune of it landing in the lap of a couple of people that read it, believed in it, was inspired by it, and went on and actually followed through and did the thing. Econo Alchemist is the prime example of it. I've said a bunch of times, I felt like he kind of like, it's almost like a baton, like I'm handing it off to him. Now you go. And now since him, he's handed it off to several other people that have now put out their own guides on mining. And suddenly within a year, this entire narrative, I've watched it on Twitter. I've watched this whole narrative change now to where it's not immediately dismissed anymore. Now we're down to the nitpicking stuff, you know, whether it's actually anonymous or private, all these little things that are. But the point is, we're past that one big front hurdle of is it even worth talking about? We're past that. That's the big one to get over. Now, once we're here and we're mining, we've got some people getting some sats in their own wallets. Now we'll figure out the little details and exactly what you need to do. And do you need to run a VPN, whatever you want to do? How private do you want it to be? But get mining first. So it's been a tremendous, this last year or so, however long it's been since I put out Mining for the Streets, it's been amazing to watch people read it and follow some recommendations in there and get on their own and then start putting their own guides out. It is an extremely humbling experience to have somebody come on Twitter and announce to the world that they are now more financially sovereign and free because of something that you wrote and put out, not knowing if anyone would read it. So it's an amazing feeling. It really is.
Just to follow up with you there, Diverter, on one point, I totally echo you on the non-KYC aspect of mining. I think that's a huge reason why everyone should look at trying to get at least one machine in their garage if they have that kind of setup. I'm supposing that the competitor to that is privacy solutions, whether that's somehow getting onboarded to Lightning pretty easily in a way that kind of secures your privacy, or maybe using some of those privacy wallets out there. And I'm not too familiar with which ones are fully working or not, but I'd be interested to hear your take on if those are like the two competitors, like mining non-KYC sats versus using privacy solutions like Wasabi or Samurai or something else.
First of all, I'm a huge Samurai and Whirlpool proponent. I very highly recommend the Whirlpool and doing coin joins and collaborative transactions. I think they are extremely important to privacy, especially when dealing with a transparent ledger. As far as Lightning goes, you know, it's not there yet, privacy wise. There's a possibility that it could get better, and I certainly hold out hope for that. As it stands today, there are ways to certainly be more private utilizing Lightning, but it's certainly not to the point where we want it to be or where we hope that it'll end up. Privacy is a huge aspect of this. And again, dealing with a transparent ledger, there's only so many ways that you can really deal with this aspect. So as Econo points out in his guides, and I think we've covered this many times, as of today, what I believe is more ideal is for people to be running a miner, running their own ASIC setup somewhere, mining to their own personal wallet. Ideally, in my mind, that would be a Samurai or a Sparrow wallet. And as soon as those payouts are come, they go straight through Whirlpool, and then you go wherever you want to go. I love these privacy best practices. I hope that everybody continues to follow through with them and get more involved in doing collaborative transactions like the either two-person coin joins or something like Whirlpool. But I think it's important not only for people to get that privacy going forward, but also to break the links coming from your mining pool payout, just to get everybody kind of off of your trail on this transparent ledger to the best of your ability. So yeah, I'm a big proponent of that.
There's so much there, Diverter, that you talked about that I want to unpack. It's awesome. Before we get to a couple of those points, though, I want to throw a question to Alex really quickly, sort of in the same vein of everything we've been talking about, but more with a bent towards like geopolitical games, I guess, and regulatory concerns. I know, Alex, you're traveling all over the world monitoring human rights and regulations and crackdowns in dozens, maybe even hundreds of different environments. And obviously, one of the biggest pieces of news in mining and like in all of Bitcoin and the cryptocurrency space this year was China's crackdown. And, you know, when these sorts of things happen, the large, well-capitalized mining companies are often in a much better position to sort of pack up and leave and move somewhere else than maybe your home miner with two or three machines in their garage. And if something gets banned, well, then they just power off. I'm curious just to know your thoughts on like the likelihood, or at least just like what people in other jurisdictions besides China should be thinking about and maybe positioning themselves for, if you think something like the same level of China's crackdown would happen again, maybe somewhere else between like now and the next halving, or in the next decade, even whatever time frame, given that, you know, at home miners are generally positioned to respond worse or poorly than large, well-capitalized mega mining conglomerates. Just sort of open-ended question there, but curious to know your thoughts on other regulatory concerns for miners that maybe you see in the near future.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it's kind of clear that even though there's some kind of like charts going around showing that Bitcoin mining in China is at zero, that's not actually the case, and there's still some mining there. And I mean, I would actually, almost to the contrary of what you just said, I would imagine that like home miners, they're still mining probably, like as opposed to the big industrial sites that were like they had to shut down, right? So I think like home mining, or like maybe not home mining, but very small operation or off-grid mining actually could be more resilient in some ways to state capture attack than large industrial scale. I would say, especially if you look at the United States and you look at what's happening kind of in the Appalachia area, there could be like, again, off-grid mining facilities that are really small that could survive an industrial crackdown. The events of this year are crazy. I don't know what to say. Like, I mean, forever, the fact that China, it seems like forever in my mind, at least since I got into Bitcoin, that the idea that more than half of the mining infrastructure was in a territory controlled by this dictatorship was terrible for Bitcoin for various reasons. And it's just incredible to see that, you know, essentially they ceded this position away. And that while there still might be some mining happening in China, it's negligible essentially. And it's all gone elsewhere. And it's just been this huge gift to the network. It's decentralized the network. And then the next question is, well, where do we go from here? Is it concerning that it's too much mining in America? And I think that's a fair question. But I think what's important to note is that it's just a different situation. Like in China, I think one of the reasons you saw a ready exodus from China was that earlier in the year, like the Chinese government had just sort of, there was like an incident where they just turned off the power to a part of the country kind of without warning, right? And then miners were probably pissed and they were like, this is not good. Maybe we should go to some other country where they're not going to do that to us anymore. So the idea of arbitrary power is not good if you're obviously mining. Like if like for whatever reason, the government could just turn off your power, not good. So I think there's a lot of fears about, that are good fears for us to have about too much mining in America. But one thing is that's important to note is we have states' rights, and there's like property rights, and there's like courts, and there's like we can sue the government, and like there's senators in Congress who are like Ted Cruz level, who are like super pro Bitcoin mining. So I think you're already starting to see the incentive structure play out in the United States, where you're going to see some states be like super pro mining, and they'll go and they'll fight the federal government on that. And I think that it's just a better environment. I've always thought that the US, even though it's risky, is a better environment for there to be like 30-40% of the mining than in China, where like literally the government could just like do what you just saw happen, obviously, in May, where they just literally kicked everybody out. So geopolitically, I think we're in a better place. I still think it's good for new miners to like the corporate, the big ones. I think like this is the, going back to what Diverter said about incentives, like they're going to be self-interested to spread out their machines jurisdictionally. Like I've already heard large acquisitions of ASICs. Like we're talking unfathomably large, double digit percentage of the hash. They're going to be spread out by their new owners intentionally, so that if something weird happens in the United States during the Biden administration, they're like de-risked. Like they're okay. They have some stuff in Northern Europe or Latin America or whatever. So I think you're witnessing a lot of good incentives play out. And again, I think for individuals, they might even be more resilient, honestly, than these big corporation, big industrial operations when it comes to state crackdowns. So I'll leave it there and I'll toss it back to Diverter.
Yeah, no, that's a great point you make. And Diverter, curious to hear your thoughts too, also on it, on sort of the resilience between like mega mining conglomerates and home miners. I think, Alex, it's a great point. You know, there's also like, as a little bit of a counterpoint, if you're sort of the only miner in a neighborhood, it would be rather trivial to see like, oh, this one house has like crazy high power bills versus, you know, the other dozen on the street. But they're obviously various levels.
Yeah, but not if you're running solar, they wouldn't know.
Like true. And that's like you said a couple times, the off-grid mining future is so bullish. But yeah, Diverter, curious to hear if you had anything to add there in terms of, you know, how you think about your position as a smaller scale home miner and some of the chilling regulatory news we've seen hit the industry this year. It also, in contrast with like coupled with that news, the open arms we've seen from around the world, including the US and Canada, accepting this sort of like homeless migrating hash rate and those sorts of regulatory power games and dynamics.
Sure. And I would just kind of echo kind of what Alex said. I do believe that an individual and smaller scale miners are because of the way that they're able to be more nimble and able to do more quickly with their operations than a large scale mining farm. There's no getting around a large scale mining farm. If you're told to shut down, you have a choice. You can either just literally defy and fight, or you know, comply. And the fight part is probably not going to work out that great if you're a large mining farm, especially if you're in one of the more despotic regimes and stuff. So I definitely think that a home miner is the more resilient of the two. As for on-grid and off-grid, these terms, I've said before that off-grid mining is the future of Bitcoin mining, and I firmly believe that. And I would just add one little thing here, and that is when we talk about off-grid, when I say off-grid, what you've got to understand what I'm meaning is not necessarily that you're actually off the grid. What I'm actually meaning is maybe you've got an ASIC, maybe even two at the most, running in, you know, your where your washer and dryer would normally be running in the United States. Essentially, you're off grid if as long as you don't have, you know, 10 or 15 ASICs running in your garage, where, as you noted, it would be very easy to notice, oh, why is this guy? You're either growing weed or mining Bitcoin. Either way, the government wants to know about it. All right. So but at a smaller scale than that, when you've got an ASIC or two, then you basically are off grid. You're still on the grid, but you blend in like everywhere else. And as anyone in any sort of privacy community would tell you, that's kind of the goal. You're supposed to blend in. You're not necessarily supposed to be so private that you actually stand out, because, you know, why is there a blank spot right here? Like there's supposed to be somebody there. So it's actually, you know, it's totally fine to be on the grid, getting your power from an actual power provider on grid, but you're getting it in such a way that it's not noticeable. It doesn't stand out. That maybe you've got an old washer or dryer that uses a little too much electricity. Your dishwasher is a bit old. Those are important distinctions. And I think there is a lot of regulation yet to come in the Bitcoin mining industry. We're very early, as evidenced by, you know, plenty of stuff around the Bitcoin world. But in one area where I think this is we're particularly early is in Bitcoin mining as far as regulations go. One area that I've spoken about that I think regulations will come for are the mining pools themselves. I believe that at some point, government agencies are very likely to try to classify these mining pool operators as money transmitters, because as the setup of almost all mining pools out there, the actual setup is once you contribute hash to the mining pool, they actually mine to their wallet. And then once it's in their wallet, they pay it out to you. So they actually do take custody of the Bitcoin. I feel like there's a lot for regulators to work with there as far as trying to classify them as money transmitters. So I think that's one problem that will eventually hit. The other one will be in companies such as, Compass, what you guys are doing here, and other companies like, you know, the Blockware Solutions, whoever are running these hosting facilities. I feel like there's an opportunity for regulators to get more information from the people that are participating in these ventures, which, as we all know, that's what it's all about. They want to get information on who is involved, who owns Bitcoin, how much do they own. They want to know everything, especially if you have apparently more than $600 in your account. So I say all that not to say that hosting facilities and all that are dead. They're dead men walking. It's just a matter of time. I say that as saying that it's important to be prepared for what you believe is yet to come. So in the case of a hosting facility, for example, in my opinion, it is the responsibility of that hosting facility to gather as little amount of data on the people participating as possible, so that when the day comes that information is requested from these regulators, you can comply by also not complying. I'll give you everything that I've got, but I don't know how much it's going to help you, because all I've got is this right here, and it's essentially nothing. So I think that's very important for people that are running like hosting facilities and things of that nature, to understand that it's in their interest from a compliance standpoint to not gather more data than what is absolutely necessary to make this transaction possible, to make things work, so that when the regulations come, as in my opinion, it is an absolute inevitability, it's just a matter of time and how they go about it, that everyone can be protected, from the miner to the actual hosting facility to whoever, the pool operator. So it's important to have an eye on these things and understand the trajectory and where we're heading, and where things could possibly be going. As Alex spoke to about, is it better now that we have more mining in the United States? I think in a lot of ways it is. I think in a lot of ways it could potentially be seen as much worse, precisely because in China, they don't play quite the same game that the United States does. They overtly exercise their power in China. So boom, ban it, shut down, out. In the United States, they're more likely to actually welcome. Yeah, come on in, come on. It's totally fine. All you've got to do is just comply with this little bitty regulation. Just give us this little bit of information. You can have all the power you want. Totally fine. And so they try to sneak in this back door, because a head-on attack, it's not going to work. As he said, in China right now, I'm quite certain there are still people mining. So a head-on ban, not so much. But if I can sneakily just get enough information to where I can lean on the right people and I can apply pressure in the right ways, then I don't have to ban it to effectively neuter the network. So, you know, there's a lot that could go into it. There's a lot that could go wrong. There's a lot that I think is coming down the line. None of it is so bad that it cannot be overcome with a little ingenuity and a little want to. So I'm bullish on it, but I think we've got some rough storms still to weather.
Need ASIC help? Check out Bitamine, one of Bitmain's certified repair shops located in Washington State, with satellite offices in Colorado, Oklahoma, and Texas. PSUs, hashboards, immersion setups, in and out of warranty repair, Bitamine has you covered. Want to train your technicians? Bring Bitamine to your site for hands-on training in the art of ASIC repair, complete with Bitmain AMTC certification. Contact Bitamine today at dan@vmasic.com. Again, that's dan@vmasic.com. When you think of ASIC repair, think Bitamine.
Yeah, I love that perspective. Kind of similar topic. We had a Twitter space yesterday and we had one participant say that mining is quickly becoming split into two camps, the suits and then the home miners or the off-grid miners or you know, the typical non-KYC miners. We're really seeing like a bifurcation in the market. And so, Damien, if you throw this tweet up, I think this kind of encapsulates it pretty well. This isn't really related to mining. It's about this ETF that came out the other day for Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. But there is like this overall movement where we're seeing Bitcoin become Wall Street-esque, and that includes mining itself. And I'm wondering about the long-term implications for that. To some degree, it's good. Obviously, ETF provides more liquidity for the space, allows more people to have access to Bitcoin. Bitcoin mining stocks, same kind of thing. Bitcoin miners going public allows them to expand their operations. But you definitely lose a little bit of that cypherpunk edge as you go along the way. I'm wondering where the danger is that going forward. I'd be curious to get both your thoughts, but Dart, or maybe start off with you really quickly.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. It's very it's very easy to see to anyone that's paying attention, this sort of bifurcation that's slowly taking place, maybe perhaps even quickly taking place. You can see it just in the discourse online. You've basically, you know, I don't know, just to break it down very simply, I mean, you've got the sailor camp of Bitcoiners and you've got the samurai camp of Bitcoiners. All right. It's just a very basic yes. breakdown right there. All right. It's obvious. There's a big bright red line drawn between them. Okay. It's not very blurry. As for what it means going forward, you know, of course, there are a lot of positives for these big players and suits getting involved as far as lending legitimacy to things, as far as, you know, it not being seen as, you know, quite so much this little nerd tool or whatever online, that people actually can use it. And what that actually does is it allows the smaller folks, the people that actually need to use Bitcoin to, you know, further their own independence and sovereignty, it actually allows them to even begin looking at it, because they then will be able to take it more seriously. So there's things that, you know, it's not all horrible. Having said that, I would be shocked for somebody to actually truly, honestly believe that any of those types, the sailor types, are really going to stand up and defend privacy and financial sovereignty when it comes to either you comply with this regulation or we ban Bitcoin in the United States, or not even ban it. We ban self-custody, I think, is the more apt approach for them to take, for them to not make Bitcoin illegal, but for them to make it illegal for you to hold your own keys. I do kind of see that in the future. I think Bitcoin was designed for this. I think it's built for it. I think we've got the people to do it. But I wonder what that would result in. I wonder what kind of impact, obviously, it would have on the price of Bitcoin, and then what that impact then has on other aspects, such as mining. When the price of Bitcoin goes down and suddenly it's not profitable for these large mining farms to be mining anymore, what happens? They're not in here for the cypherpunk ethos. They're here to make some money. So when they're not making money, they're out. So what are you left with mining? Well, you got your cypherpunks, and then the crackdown goes for them. You know, now we're into the electric. So it's like a domino effect, obviously, that you knock one down and you just go from there. I don't think it's so bad that there will have to be some sort of chain split. I don't want to see the network split. I hope that doesn't happen. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility. But I hope that what we can find is a way where we don't have to rely on the good graces of lawmakers in this country or any other in order for us to participate in this network. I want it to remain as permissionless as possible. Within reason, there are certain things that, you know, that can maybe be worked with, but I feel like we've compromised quite a bit already. And I don't think there's a whole lot more compromise to come from our side. I think we're going to have to put ourselves in a position where we force them to compromise and to come to us. If you want access to Bitcoin and the obvious things that Bitcoin brings with it, then you're going to have to compromise and understand that doing that means you have to allow people to have more privacy and sovereignty and personal freedom. Otherwise, we're just going to go our separate ways, because Bitcoin can live on its own. It'll be hobbled. It'll be hurt, but it can live. So I think that's kind of where we're at. I'm compromised out. I know a lot of other people feel like I'm compromised as far as I can compromise. Now you guys are going to have to meet us. Otherwise, we're just going to go.
Totally love that answer. Alex, I want to give you a moment to answer as well. I guess the question is more about regulatory capture of Bitcoin mining. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, there's two perspectives. One is to be, very concerned and lucid about the risks. But the other is just to go back like 8 years in time and to think about the fact that there'd be like publicly traded Bitcoin mining companies. It's insane. So like, if Bitcoin is to be successful, all of these things will happen, right? It's just inevitable. Like the more that this thing grows, the more that it becomes more valuable, the more that people around the world wake up to what it is and why they should opt into it and what, how it can be useful for them. All of these milestones will be like something we walk over. Like, we're going to have nation state adoption. We're going to have publicly traded companies. We're going to have ETFs. Like, it's just, it's inevitable as something monetizes and becomes valuable and people realize what it is. So I view it not as a problem, but actually as part of the adoption cycle and actually as part of Bitcoin's kind of game theory. Because, you know, look, the battle that we want to have is not, will it be adopted? I mean, that's not really where you want to be. The battle you want to have is, oh, it's going to be adopted. Like, how's it going to go? That's the battle you want to have. So that's the battle we're going to get. And it's going to get adopted for sure. So the question is, you know, how can we best ensure that the average user is able to really take full advantage of Bitcoin's properties? And I would say we're in decent position to, you know, at least for the next 6 to 12 months for that to be realized for millions of people around the world. Like governments are not preventing KYC services from withdrawals in most countries, like as far as I can tell. Even here in the United States, like we're kingdom of KYC. I think Square's about to add Lightning withdrawal to Cash App. I mean, that's fucking awesome. Like, I don't know. Like, we'll see. And I agree that there's privacy risks on Lightning, but there are also massive privacy improvements happening. And I'm someone who believes that within like 1 to 2 years, like basically withdrawing on Lightning will be very much like withdrawing cash from a bank account. We're like, yeah, the government knows that they know exactly how much money you make it comes into your Wells Fargo account, but you withdraw that cash, they don't know what you're going to do with it. I think that's kind of where we're going to be for a lot of people with Bitcoin is like, whether it's a company like Paxful, if you live in Nigeria, that's your bank account. Maybe they'll know how much money you have. And maybe in the United States, your bank and your government knows, but they may not know what you do with it. And I think that's like a very big upgrade for us in a world where otherwise without Bitcoin, we'd be like totally screwed. So I'm excited about some of the privacy things in the coming up. And I think that all of these big risks about corporations are inevitable. Like, they were going to come. You can't have a world where Bitcoin is successful and none of the like people you don't like use it. They're all going to use it. Dictators, corporations, regulators, everybody's going to use it if it's successful. So these things were all inevitable. So it's about our ability to just use the time we have and use the fact that for whatever reason, Bitcoin's hard to understand. It buys us time. Like, we still have time. We still have months and months and months and months to onboard people and to get themselves sovereign. So let's use the tools. Let's, you know, use the guides that Diverter and other people make, and let's keep spreading the knowledge because our governments are clueless. I mean, relatively clueless. I mean, maybe the U.S. government is a little more clued in, but most senators, most of the politicians are totally clueless, and certainly most world governments are, outside of a handful. I mean, the Ethiopians are like bringing in Cardano. They have no idea what's going on. No idea. And that's a huge government of like 110 million people. So like, we're in this like early phase where like we can really make that difference during the adoption cycle. Maybe it won't be the case in 10 years, but we can do it now. So let's do as much as we can. And again, all of these obstacles we had to fight them at some point. So we're going to have to fight them now, you know?
No, I think you're spot on there with all of these things are like, it's inevitable. Bitcoin mining growth is inevitable. Bitcoin adoption generally is inevitable. And I think, you're just spot on. The charge for us, I guess, is to make sure that the home mining, the plebs, the average user, the sort of cypherpunk ethos that catalyzed this huge movement is not lost in the growing cacophony of adoption by more and more parties and types of parties and things, but that home miners are still able to easily and privately mine Bitcoin and secure their sats and all these sorts of things.
So let's get ASICs in Walmart.
Yeah.
No, exactly. I'm serious. Like, that's the goal, is to get ASICs available to the average American and make them not that, you know, hopefully they'll get a little cheaper as we go on. And the technology life cycle is such that they hang around for 3, 4, 5 years. They're useful. If I could walk into a Walmart and pay cash for an ASIC, like, that's a good, we're in the right direction there. That'd be a good direction.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I think a lot of the times this cypherpunk ethos thing, people take nuance out of the discussion often. You know, I mean, Twitter's not a real place. So, you know, you're not dealing in the real world when you're on Twitter. You know, we're talking about real world implications here. Like, this cypherpunk ethos thing, it's important that we understand it. But at the end of the day, a world in which someone can hold their own Bitcoin keys is so exponentially better, regardless of anything else that's done. If you can hold your own Bitcoin keys and do what you want with your own Bitcoin, that world is exponentially better than anything other than it. So, you know, it's great to be completely into privacy and sovereignty, and I want people to be interested and do all the things that they can. But it's important to note the very, very specific, hard and fast red lines that cannot be crossed. And then the rest of it we'll talk about. Custody, self-custody being a major one of those.
Yeah, yeah. Just to end on a positive note, I mean, we all talk about the ways it could go wrong. But what if it goes right? And what if, like in America, think about like AutoZone, or think about the culture around cars and fixing your car. What if like Bitcoin mining becomes like that? And like in every small town in America, there's a Bitcoin mining store, and there's an ASIC community, and there's people who have a club, and they're constantly like, they love coming into the store and talking about Bitcoin mining. It could go that way. It could go that way. It could go, right, Diverter? Like, it's possible, yeah, right?
Absolutely. I literally just sent a text message the other day to somebody whenever Bitcoin hit all-time high again. And I said, what if we're actually right? Like, what if we're actually, like, not just on Twitter, like, what if we're actually right? You know, like, this is crazy.
That's amazing. Yeah, I love that vision. An ASIC in every home, 110 terahash in every house. ASICs in Walmart, ASIC repairs in every county. Beautiful.
Well,
we are at the top of the hour.
Sorry. Yeah, that's just so that we can make a dent in it. And thanks so much for having us. It was a lot of fun.
Exactly. Yeah. No, thank you guys for coming on. This was a very fun conversation for both Will and I, and hopefully for everyone watching. Alex and Diverter are both on Twitter. You can find their accounts linked in the description below this video. If you aren't already, definitely throw them a follow. They're very insightful, thought-provoking individuals. But Alex and Diverter, to both of you, thank you so much for coming on today. Absolute pleasure chatting with you. Have to do it again soon, but enjoy the rest of your Friday and your weekend, and thanks for doing this with us.
Yeah, appreciate you guys.
Thanks,
yeah,
thanks so guys.
See you guys later. Take care.
See you.
Spring is in full bloom. Are your finances? With the Chime Secured Credit Builder Visa Credit Card, you can build credit with everyday purchases and regular on-time payments, all with no annual fees or interest. With Chime Secured Credit Card, you can start improving your credit scores right away. Get started today at chime.com/build. That's chime.com/build. Chime. Feels like progress.
The Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card is issued by Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Out-of-network ATM withdrawal and OTC advance fees may apply. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.